Hi, everybody. My name is Bill. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Bill.
Happy holidays.
Yeah.
If anybody wasn't here last week, that is here this week, I gave everybody last week a Christmas present, so come and get it after the meeting. So you guys have heard of, you know, AA and Al-Anon, Alateen. Well, these are two members of Alipup. So this is always very exciting. So as we transition from 2 to 3 into 4 and 5, I'm going to hopefully cover 4 and 5 tonight. I heard a spiritual man say something unrelated to AA, but I really saw it as a really great observation about step 2 and 3. And what he said was, "We can't say 'Thy kingdom come' until we say 'My kingdom go.'" And another way of putting that is, if you're going to have a real strong sense of Spirit's presence, there's got to be a real strong sense of your own absence. So the third step talks about that, you know, selfishness, self-centeredness, that's the root of our troubles, that our troubles of our own making. And another great man said that if I'm trying to make myself unself-centered, I'm still being self-centered. So really, we have to get out of the way. We just have to get out of the way. And since higher power, conscious contact, God, whatever you want to call it, is always and already here, then especially we need to get out of the way, because our best thinking is what has kept us blocked our whole entire life. So it's always kind of interesting to me. And especially, you know, we live in America where it's all about, you know, pick yourself up from your bootstraps and you know, make it happen, you know what I mean? And we come to AA and they tell us, no, don't make it happen, let it happen, which is two completely different things. So one of the things I always like sharing in transitioning from 3 to 4 is what has been called the Step 3 Parable, which is one of the greatest captures of the essence of Step 3 I've ever heard. And it goes like this. A drunk is staggering along the street and he meets God. "God, I can't do this anymore," he says. "Please, please, will you give me sobriety?" God says, "Sobriety isn't free. How much money do you have?" The drunk reaches into his pocket. $50. "I'll take it," says God. "You're sober." The man stands up straight, drunk no more. "It feels pretty good." "Yeah, but God?" "Yes." "I know I gave you my money willingly, but you see, I need gas for my car." God says, "You have a car?" And he says, "Well, yes." And he says, "You didn't tell me that. I'll take the car too." "But wait," God interrupts and says, "I'll take the car. It's part of the price for your sobriety." "But how will I get to work?" "You have a job?" "I'll take the job too." "But God, how will I pay my mortgage?" "Mortgage? You have a house? I'll take that too." "But God, my family, how will I take care of them if you have my house and my job?" And God says to him gently and lovingly, "In order to keep your sobriety, you must give me all these things. But I will let you drive my car as long as you remember it's my car. You can have the job, but remember you're working it for me. It's my house, but I will let you live in it. And as for the family, they are my family, but I will trust that you will take care of them." So the last thing about 3 for me, which is always really interesting, is that, you know, people think that, you know, this decision to turn our will and our life over is some really significant major kind of change. But if you really look at it, it's talking about my will and my life. First of all, it's talking about a decision. A decision always requires further action. So in other words, we all decided to come here tonight, but if we didn't take the action necessary, that decision means nothing. So the third step is merely a decision to go on with the rest of the process. It says in the third step, it's one of the few paragraphs in the book that I'm willing to admit that I have memorized, because I share it constantly, because this one paragraph absolutely changed my life. Because up until I saw the reality and experienced what the paragraph was talking about, I was always stuck in self-will, and I would start in the morning and say, you know, God, take my will, and then I take it back, and I give up my will, and I take it back. And what the third step lines are is, though my decision, which is the third step decision, is a vital and crucial step. So it's pretty important. It's vital and crucial. It's very important. It could have little permanent effect. In other words, it won't amount to anything. It'll have little permanent effect unless at once, which means now, immediately, unless at once, has little permanent effect unless at once followed up by, it's leaving my mind. This is amazing. I've had that part in my head for so long, I'm just not remembering it today. It says, though our decision is a vital and crucial step, but it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and to be rid of the things in ourselves which have been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. So it's it has little permanent effect unless at once, by a strenuous effort, which means, you know, intensely active, to face, and where we face this stuff is in 4, 5, and 6, and to be rid of, and where we get rid of this stuff is in 7, 8, and 9, the things in ourselves which have been blocking us. We had to get down to causes and conditions. So in step 3, we're not turning our will and our life over to the care of God yet. We're making a decision to move in that direction. If resentment is still telling me what to do, then God's not telling me what to do. If fear is driving my life, God's not driving my life. If shame and guilt and remorse is a major part of my life, God's being blocked off. So the only way that I can turn my will and my life over is by doing 4 through 9, or rather 4 through 12. And that's what removes, what blocks me from being able to turn my will and my life over. And then and only then can I actually start doing it. So, you know, there's people in AA that say, well, just do the first 3 steps for a while. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Some people call it the AA waltz. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. But you see, that's completely contradictory to what the instructions say. It says that 3 means nothing unless I go on. And I was, for a couple years, I was trying to live in 1, 2, 3 and to try to do 3 and to try to turn my will and my life over. But it was not a possibility and I kept taking it back. And then, and only when I went on with the rest of the process and I started looking at my resentments and getting rid of them and looking at my fears and getting rid of them and looking at the harms that I had done and the shame and the guilt and the craziness that it created within me, then and only then was I then able to have a connection with a higher power that could work through me and that could guide me in my life. So, 3 means almost nothing. It's very important, but it means almost nothing unless we go on at once, immediately. And then there's the famous Don P. quote that says, you know, anything at all that I have in mind for myself, anything at all that God has in mind for me, is better than anything at all that I will ever have in mind for me. I need to understand the craziness that I caused in my life. The fourth step is literally, how am I causing the problems in my life and where am I playing God? That's what the fourth step is all about. How am I causing the problems in my life and where am I playing God? Now, something that's really interesting and something that's really, really important about step 4 is that it's almost like 2 and 3... sort of, it doesn't get too specific and it doesn't get too descriptive, but what 2 and 3 does in a really good way is point out the need for a higher power, but it doesn't say much about what this higher power thing is. And then after 2 and 3 points us in the direction of, we need a higher power because we can't do it ourselves because our best thinking keeps getting us here. The book then says, all right, enough about that. Let's give you a major example of what it looks like and what it feels like when you're running the show and your higher power is not there. So then it gives us 4 and 5. And it gives us the nightmare of my life run on my will. And it's really kind of amazing. And then, you know, and then we get into, we share it in five, and then we see some stuff we don't particularly like about ourselves, and we ask God to help us with that in six and seven. We start making amends, so the shame and the guilt starts to drop. And then, again, it doesn't really describe the whole higher power thing very much. And then it starts getting into, okay, well, now I'm a little bit clearer. Now I'm a little bit less in the mode of self-sabotage. And now we're going to work with some practices, prayer, meditation, inventory, etc., working with others, practicing principles. And then it begins to put us in touch with something inside of us that could be a little bit different for each of us. That's the strange thing about alcoholism, is that the good news is that the solution is inside of you. And the bad news is that the problem is inside of you. And now we need to distinguish between, you know, it's Hollywood has a really good description of the angel and the devil on our shoulder. Spirituality becomes, you know, which voice am I listening to at any one moment? And if I'm listening to the devil on my shoulder, then I can recognize that, because I'm going to be given a huge, major overview of what it looks like and what it feels like when I'm listening to the wrong voice called steps four and five. My life run on my will. Hardly being a success. Hardly being a success is an understatement. I would call it, my life run on my will is a nightmare. It's not only a nightmare for me, but it's a nightmare for people in my life. That, you know, I don't suffer well, and I don't suffer alone. I dump it on everybody around me, and I take it out on everybody around me. And it's scary, because, you know, people run from us screaming. And, you know, and then we have our families, which, you know, it's hard for families to kind of run away from you, but, you know, we torture those people to a max also. So, in the big book, there's three inventories and what I would call a creation of an ideal. The first inventory is resentment, the second inventory is fear, and the third inventory is sex and harms. And then it talks about, as far as I see it, creating a relationship ideal. I find it interesting because the 12 and 12 gets into it a little bit more deeply, but it talks about... it talks about the three basic instincts of life, that all humans have these three basic instincts. One instinct is the social instinct, one instinct is the security instinct, and the other instinct is not crossing my mind.
Security.
No, security is fear, social is harms. What's the resentment one? It also begins with an S.
Self-esteem?
No.
Sex.
Wow, my mind is like not
shelter.
Here today. What was that?
Shelter.
No.
That's security.
Mm. I don't think I have it in here.
Well, self-esteem, your inhibitions, personal or sex related.
Yeah, that's not what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Wow. And the first basic instinct, when used incorrectly, brings about resentment. And coincidentally, our first inventory is a resentment inventory. And then the security instinct brings about fear. When we use it incorrectly and selfishly, it brings about fear, and that's the second inventory. And then the social instinct, when you selfishly and incorrectly, it brings about harms to others, and that's the third inventory we have. So the three inventories... correlate directly with our three basic instincts of life. So the inventories get to the root. They don't just deal with some random set of things. It deals directly with the basic instincts of life, and the inventories get down to the core of what's really going on. You see, the essence of the fourth step is mentioned in the fifth step description, where it says the exact nature of your wrongs. It's not just that we did certain things. It's why did I do those things? So for the first time, I don't know about you guys, but for the first time I started really looking at you know, how have I been doing so far with my running of my life? And it didn't go well. But I didn't really see it so much because, I don't know about you, I'm sure nobody here can relate to this, but like I blamed everybody else for my stuff. You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't that, you know, I'm so selfish and self-centered that it can't be me that's for blame because, you know, I'm Superman. I'm superhuman. So it's obviously got to be your fault and your problem. I'm still waiting for that word to pop into my head.
Well, I just did that, the social, the security, and the sense.
Yeah. Where did you get that from?
I just looked up the instincts, and then it went into 12 and 12.
Right, so the social instinct is resentment, the security instinct is a fear, and the sex instinct is harms. That when we use the social instinct selfishly and incorrectly, it brings about resentment. And don't get me wrong, it doesn't mean that, you know, with the social instinct, it also could bring about fear or whatever. But, you know, it's the kind of thing where basically there's these three outcomes for us and for anybody that's using the basic instincts incorrectly, and that's resentment, fear, and harms. So we look at the first inventory, which is the resentment inventory. Now, over and over and over and over again, there must be about 15 references in this part of the book, which is the How It Works part of the book, and just after it, that it hammers the wrongness and darkness of resentment. As a matter of fact, just before it introduces the resentment inventory, it talks about that resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. Mm-hmm. And I always share that, you know, when I first read that, when my sponsor was taking me through the book, I said, you know, I don't think I agree with that. I think alcohol destroys more alcoholics than anything else. And he actually said something to me that I learned to really hate, and he said to me, well, Bill, let's look at that. And I was just like, what? You know, like, and he said, well, let's look at that. He goes, alcohol can only destroy an alcoholic when we're drinking. Resentment can destroy an alcoholic whether we're drinking or not. Mm. And I was just like, oh, you know, so anytime after that, he said to me, well, let's look at that. That was when I knew that I am a complete idiot. I shouldn't have opened my mouth. And so resentment destroys more alcoholics than anything else. The worst thing I can say about resentment is that resentment blocks you off from the only power that can help you in dealing with your alcoholism. Resentment blocks me off from God. And the word resent is sort of an interesting word, so let me describe it, because it's important to understand what the word resent means. And that is that the word resent comes from the word sentire, which means to feel. And when you put a re in front of it, it means again. So resent means to feel again any negative emotions that you might be feeling. So it could be major negative feelings like, you know, rage and serious anger, or minor negative emotions like frustration, or, you know, just people that regularly annoy you. That's all resentment. Big or small, it's resentment. It's re-feeling negative emotions. That some people can experience something and they get sort of angry about it, but then they're able just to let it go. I don't know about you, but I'm not able to do that. I not only hold on to it, but I can hold on to it for years. I can hold on to it well past the stage where they're even alive anymore. You know what I mean? Like, I'm sure nobody here had resentment toward people that had died. You know what I mean? Because I know I did. You know, like the famous saying is that, you know, resentment is like taking poison and expecting the other person to get sick. These people that are no longer alive are certainly not worried about me. I'm the one that's totally bugged out about them from something that happened 10 years ago. So we have a resentment inventory. For me, it was absolutely amazing when I sat down to write my first resentment inventory, because in a very brief period of time, just like maybe 2 days, because when Howard took me through the work, I actually completed my entire four step in 1 week. I completely dedicated myself. I was working for AT&T. I was working for AT&T. I was working 2 hours overtime every day during the week. And I was also going to meetings regularly. And I did my first and most extensive four-step in 1 week. My resentment inventory, my fear inventory, my harms inventory, the whole thing, I finished in 1 week. Mm-hmm. So when I work with people, I give them like 3 weeks. So there's nobody that can tell me they can't do it because I did it in way under that. So, and what I discovered, like just in a couple of days, was I'm pissed at everybody. I don't just have like a couple of resentments. Mm-hmm. Like people that, you know, were in my life for relatively brief periods of time, and everybody that was in my life for more than just a brief period of time were all prominently on the list. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had issues with everybody. And that was, you know, I've talked about a spiritual teacher one time asked me to work with something, and they asked me, they said, what's the worst thing that ever happened to you? And I was like, oh, that's interesting, yet I would really love to do that. Because, you know, sometimes the ego pops up and says, yeah, I'm doing that. That's a good one. You know, I'm gonna trash somebody now. And it was funny because, you know, I started rattling off some things within me. And each time I brought up one that I thought was probably the worst thing that ever happened to me, there was a piece of me that was like, nah, that's not it yet. And, you know, there's some outrageous things in my past. And then I sort of brought it into prayer and meditation. And what I landed on as what was the worst thing that ever happened to me was that I was incapable of loving another human being. That was the worst thing that ever happened to me because I was so selfish and self-centered that, you know, like, I like you, or let's say I get to the point where I love you, but then you don't live up to my expectation. You start doing something that I don't think you should be doing, and now I need to withhold my love because you don't deserve it because you're not acting the way I want you to. One of the greatest ways I've ever heard resentment described is, on the occasion of your behavior, I upset myself. That's one of the greatest definitions of resentment I've ever heard. On the occasion of your behavior, I upset myself. That's what's going on there, ladies and gentlemen. That's what's going on there. This has nothing to do with them at all. It's never what they do that's the problem. It's never what they do that's the issue. What I tell myself about what they do is the issue. We've all experienced, let's say we're married and we live with our husband or wife. We've all experienced, you know, your average Tuesday or Wednesday night, they come home from work and they're kind of spitting bullets and they kind of start an argument with us and it goes. It just goes. We jump in with all fours and we just go at it. You know what I mean? And we've all also experienced that. Let's say we come home a few weeks later and it's a Friday and we're sort of just, it's sort of a Friday, we're sort of in a weekend mode, we're a little bit more spiritually connected, and they come home and do the exact same thing and we don't jump in, it doesn't affect us at all. And we just say, oh, you know, it sounds like you're having a bad day. You know what I mean? We've all experienced the exact same thing and we get two completely different responses. In the first one, we just had at it. In the second one, we didn't take it personally and it didn't mean anything to us. We didn't tell ourselves anything about what they were doing that day. And the other time, we did tell ourselves about what they were doing, that it was wrong, and now we got to argue. Hmm. I was listening to another spiritual teacher, and he was talking about, I can't remember, he was talking about anger or something, and I said, wow, this is describing resentment in a way I've never heard, in a much better way than I've ever heard described. And what he was able to do is just slow resentment down and to break it into pieces in such a perfect way. It's absolutely amazing how these people can do this. And what he said was is that resentment has four parts. He goes, part one, I judge you. Part two, I find you guilty. Part three, I start to feel anger or frustration or whatever the emotion is. And then part four, I start to re-feel the anger and the frustration. And now it's a resentment. So you can easily see in what I'm describing that the problem isn't, after it's already got out of control, the problem is that I created it because I judged you and I found you guilty. That's where the resentment is. That's what we have to look at. That's why we got to get to the core of it. That's why we have to look at the root of it. Because It's not what they do that's the problem. It's what I tell myself. It's what I do with what's going on that's the problem, not what it is that goes on. This is all really, really important. This is all life-changing stuff, ladies and gentlemen. You know what I mean? Like, this is when my life started changing. This is when my interaction with life started changing. This is when I started finding answers for life. And the only answer that I had for life was, you know, drink and drug, because there's people out there. And the other tools for living were, you know, anger and, you know, putting people down and, you know what I mean? My last name is Lash, and I'm really good at lashing out at people, believe me. So then it talks about a resentment inventory. And the first column is, you know, who am I resentful at? One thing that I would like you to remember is we can also, if it's a regret, we're resenting ourselves. So that would need to be included. And then the second column is, why do I have the resentment? And boy, does my ego love putting that list together. That was the most enjoyable experience I had had in years. Was, oh man, I get to write these people down and say why I'm so pissed. And one of the things I do with my step work with people that I work with is I say to them, be as petty as you feel. Don't be spiritual. Write down exactly how you feel. I remember one time I listened to a fifth step, and during the whole entire fifth step, the guy really, really went for it, and he really, really just expressed how he felt. And next to every guy's name, he said, "Steve, that bastard." And then, you know, said whatever it was that happened. And then, you know, put, you know, Sarah that, you know, B word. You know what I mean? Like, he really, really went for it. Like, he was expressing just how petty his mind was about a lot of this stuff. It was, like, really cool to listen to, actually, because he really went for it. And he really didn't hold anything back at all. Because we are so petty. We are so pathetic. Mm-hmm. We are so, you know, judgmental and crazy. We're just crazy. And then the third column talks about, you know, how did this resentment make you feel? Did it affect my pride? Did it affect my self-esteem? Did it affect my personal relations? Did it affect my sex relations? Did it affect my pocketbook? There's these seven areas of self that's talked about on page 65. And the first three columns are kind of interesting because the first three columns, we learn nothing. There's no transformative value to the first three columns. We know who we're pissed at, we know why we're pissed at them, and we know how it made us feel. There's actually websites online that say that the resentment inventory is just the first three columns, and it's silly because the first three columns, we learn nothing. There's no transformative elements in the first three columns. And I guess the only thing really that I got out of the first three columns was I was really surprised at how many people, because, you know, you really only have sort of one thing in your head at a time. But when I really sat down and I really, like, sort of went in there and let my mind just kind of go off on my whole life, it was just absolutely amazing how many people I was pissed at. But then the book takes this page and a half break that's really, really, really important. And what this break does is, in the first three columns, we come from our head and we write down the issues that we have and how it made us feel. And then in between the third and the fourth column, it takes this break where we need to shift from head to heart. And then the fourth column, we need to do something completely different. We need to come from a completely different place. There needs to be a softening of our heart. We need to introduce the F word to the situation. Forgiveness. You know what I mean? There's this famous saying by Lily Tomlin, this really great comedian. She said that forgiveness is giving up on a better past. I love that. I love that expression. Forgiveness is giving up on a better past. There's a prayer that I use in between the third and the fourth column. Can you go online when your phone's shut off? No, it's in airplane mode. Is somebody's phone on? Hold on a second. I think I might have it. No, I don't.
You want to
go to Google?
I need to go online. It's a really, really profound prayer, and it's been really helpful for a lot of people. Because like I said, we really need to come from a completely different angle. We really need to come from a different place. Oh, this phone is really small.
I knew you were going to say that. I know.
It's all right, though. I'll get it. And again, this prayer, it's a sort of a game changer as far as I'm concerned. I found this prayer one time. And I actually changed it because I'm one of those kind of guys that it was a really good prayer, but I made it better. And it's funny because the guy who created it, I showed him my updated version of it, and he liked it so much that he's going to start using it. So he created a prayer. I made it better, and now he uses my prayer. That's how superior I am.
Yeah. That's awesome.
The prayer goes like this. Let's say I have a resentment towards somebody named John. The prayer goes like this. God, John is perhaps a spiritually blocked person. Whether he is or not, this resentment is blocking me spiritually. Please help me to show John the same tolerance, compassion, and patience that I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. Please forgive me from being angry and enable me to stop clinging to this resentment. Please remove this resentment and show me how I can take a kindly and tolerant view of John. Please show me how I can be helpful to John. Thy will be done. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a completely different way of looking at it. Because you see, something that I've learned and something that's really been helpful to me, and it's the kind of thing that, you know, we need to start getting a different perspective. And some of these perspective changes that have been the ones that really helped me the most, I still to this day don't know if I even completely agree with this new perspective, but the new perspective works so well that it doesn't matter to me whether I agree with it or not. You know what I mean? Because sort of intellectually, some of us just want to hold on to stuff. But if we are to the point where we have to get rid of this stuff, it doesn't matter what works. You know what I mean? Like, a drowning person isn't going to say, no, you know, I don't like a red life raft. You know, send me a blue one. You know what I mean? Like I'm drowning and I'm desperate. Like, whatever you send me, I'm going to take it. You know what I mean? Like, I don't care what color it is. I don't care what sexual orientation you are. You're saving my life. Like, you know what I mean? I'm totally desperate. I don't care about petty details. If it works, it works. Period. That's it. And this thing that has been really, really helpful to me is something that I never considered before, and that I guess you could say I still argue with it, but it's you can't argue with it. You know what I mean? Like, it's absolutely the truth. And what I'm talking about is that every single person that you've ever crossed paths with did the best they could. Period. You know, people didn't wake up and say, I'm going to screw Bill today. Now, there were people that woke up and said, I'm going to screw Bill today. But you know what I mean? Like, the other 99.9% of the world woke up and did something, and I had an issue with it. You know what I mean? Every single person that ever crossed paths with me did the best they could with the tools that they had. And I'm sorry to have to tell you this. Every single thing you ever did, you did the best you could with the tools that you had. But the cool thing about the steps is that now it's time to get better tools. Now it's time to get spiritual tools. And then and only then can anything change. Right, Pooch? Is that right, Pooch?
Yes.
Look at you. So, you know, this is... Our mind wants to argue with this, you know what I mean? But what do you mean? Like, my mom should have treated me better, you know what I mean? Like, my mom should have, you know, whatever, you know what I mean? My girlfriend should have, you know what I mean? You know, my wife shouldn't have slept with my brother, you know what I mean? Like, you know, like, that didn't happen in my life, but I'm just throwing examples out. every single person that ever crossed paths with us did the best they could with the tools that they had, period. There were other times where they showed up better, granted. And then all of a sudden things start to change a little bit. Oh, they did the best they could. And then the other thing that's mind-blowing for me about resentment, which you know, I learned this early on, and it still doesn't cease to amaze me. This is absolutely, you know, shocking life stuff that it seems just crazy, but it still surprises me. And that is that the people that we are usually most pissed at did the same thing we did. Like, you know, if you're a cheater, you get super pissed at people that cheat on you. You know what I mean? Like, you know, like... And what's going on there is that we recognize something in somebody else that we don't like about ourselves. We see it in them, but we don't want to look at it in ourselves. Most of the time, like I remember I was listening to a fifth step one time, and the guy on three or four occasions was really, really pissed at somebody because they ratted him out over something that he was doing. And after he talked about it three or four times, then by the fifth time, I said, wait a minute. I need to ask you a question. He's like, what? I said, did you ever rat anybody out? And he put his head down and goes, yeah. I was just like, man, you are so busted. How can you be pissed at people that did something that you also did? Hmm. You know what I mean? And literally what's happening there is that we see in somebody else something we don't like about ourselves, and that's it. That's what's going on. If anything, we should thank them for showing it to us, you know what I mean? For sticking it in our face. Because we're just so brain dead that we don't even pick up on it, you know what I mean? Until somebody points something like that out. Another thing that's always, it's not surprising to me anymore, it's totally predictable for me, but what's surprising to me is that it's still surprising to people when I point it out. That's the part that always drives me a little nuts, because it's like, how could you not see this? And what I mean is that, you know, you're listening to a fifth step and somebody's talking about resentment and, you know, something happened at work and you know, somebody did something or somebody said something and now all of a sudden I don't have a job there anymore and I'm really pissed. Like, it shouldn't have happened that way, right? And then this is what always happens. I would say almost 99% of the time this is what happens. I say to him, oh, by the way, okay, so you're pissed at John because he said something to your boss and then you got fired. He's like, yeah. I said, you know, I could see where you could be really pissed at John about that. Yeah, I know what you mean. And if anybody ever hears me say that, you need to know that you are about to be so busted. And then I'll say to him, oh, by the way, what was the next job that you got? Oh, it was a much better job. You know, like, I was making more money than I ever made at that job. And I'd be like, so why are you pissed at John? He did you a favor. You got a better job right after that. Like, and you're pissed at John? Like, did you want to stay there when after you left there you got a better job? Oh, I never noticed that. Hmm. You know what I mean? This is how life works. This is how life works. It's crazy. It's crazy because we want to, like, hold on to our resentments. You know what I mean? Like, we are, you know, there's no such thing as a not justified resentment. We are, and everybody around us is co-signing it. You know what I mean? Like, this is so wrong. You know, this is so wrong. And, you know, what's funny is that, you know, it says that resentment destroys more alcoholics than anything else. And then we dedicate whole meetings to, oh, who here has an issue? You know, what's today's topic? Oh, here has an issue. So now we're going to dedicate a whole meeting to resentment when resentment destroys more alcoholics than anything else. That sounds like a good idea. That's called human thought at its best. There's nothing wrong with sharing our issues. But then it's a problem meeting, and that's not helpful to anybody. What's helpful to people is that, yeah, if you have an issue, share it. It's not a problem. Share your issue. But also share with us what steps and spiritual practices you're doing to deal with the problem. Then it's a solution meeting. And now we're being useful to our old-timers, and now we're being useful to new people, and we're not driving them the hell out of here because we're not always talking about our problems. I've shared at meetings where, you know, it's like a speaker discussion meeting, and I share for a half hour, and I do my thing, and I throw up on a group, and then now it's going to be a discussion meeting. And, you know, people will say, you know, the person who shared throws out a topic. So I'll say, okay, well, this is the topic. If anybody wants to talk about problems, I'd like you to also share with us what steps and what spiritual practices you're using to deal with the problem. And then the whole meeting just sits there and just like stares at me because they're not doing anything about the problem. Mm-hmm. They're not using steps or using spirituality to deal with the problem. They just wanted to throw up on a group and leave. And I'm not trying to tell AA what to do. All I'm saying is that there's old-timers that won't even go to AA anymore because we're just tired of all your problems. And there's new people that are just like, is this what AA has to offer? We sit around and share our problems? Like, how does this help me? What am I learning about life? What am I learning about... Is this it? Mm-hmm. And it's strange because, you know, it's so foreign to whole groups that I throw that out as a topic and then nobody has anything to share because nobody's doing anything with their problems and dealing with steps and dealing with spirituality. We have a 12-step program. It's the only transformative element of the whole entire thing called AA, and nobody's working with it. And it works so well. This is what early AA was about. We allow newcomers to come to our houses and share their problems, and we share with them how we deal with those problems by using the steps and using spirituality. That's what AA started as. That was what it started as. Is that what it is today? Do you see that a lot going on at your meetings when you go each week? Where did AA go? It's really funny because, you know, sometimes when I tell my story, I guess on some level I'm almost like slapping some people in the face, but like sometimes when I share my story, I say, you know, can you really call yourself a member of a 12-step fellowship if you haven't worked the 12 steps? Like, what are we doing here? So then, what happens between the third and the fourth column introduces the transformative element. It introduces a softening of our heart, and it introduces us to coming from a completely different place than from what put together the first three columns. And then it introduces, you know, maybe a concept sort of like forgiveness or a different perspective or a shift from head to heart. And then it says, okay, well, here's the fourth column. You know, what are our mistakes? Where were we selfish? Where were we dishonest? Where were we self-seeking? Where were we afraid? And then I'm just like, what? Like, no, you don't understand. They screwed me over. What do you mean, what's my mistakes? What are you talking about? Well, if they're to blame, and the only thing that you have to deal with is that you're a victim, how are you going to get out of that? Because, you see, this is a really extreme thing to say, but victims don't get sober. Because sober and miserable is not a reasonable option. There's a big difference between being sober and being sober and happy about it. What AA has to offer is that we're just living our life and we're sober and we're just digging life and we're stepping out easy. And nothing's freaking us out everywhere we go. There's a topic you can have at one of your meetings. Please share about how life's not freaking you out anymore. Not going to get a lot of people raising their hands, I'll tell you that. Right. Especially around the holidays, right? There's a famous spiritual teacher.
Oh my God.
He says that one of the greatest ways to see how you're doing spiritually is spend a week with your parents. Good luck with that one, right? So then, and only then, does it introduce a transformative element, and that is a softening of our heart, a different perspective, and now what's my mistakes? What did I do? What did I not do? What did I choose in my mind to look at that's creating this? Because like I said, the fourth step is about two things. How am I creating all my problems, and where am I playing God? That's what the fourth step is. Mm-hmm. How am I creating all my problems? All is a very important word. How am I creating all of my problems? That's the fourth step. And where am I playing God? That's your fourth step. That's what you're going to find out in your fourth step. And let me give you an example of my first ex-wife, and the key word there is first. You know, we were together for 3.5 years. She was my first relationship. So, you know, I thought, you know, she was the first woman that I slept with, and then I married her. These are the things I do. I don't know what you guys did, but this is what I did. I follow her around like a puppy. That's what goes on. You know what I mean? Like, she'll have me, so I guess I'll like her. You know what I mean? Like, you know, my drinking and drugging, you know, I was incapable of being in a relationship. That's the most honest thing I could say to you. I was incapable of being in a relationship. Period. You know. I was a, you know, a 4-year-old child. I was pathetic. I was self-centered to the extreme. I would do things like, this was just an average night. You know, like we would go drinking after work, and then, you know, I was supposed to go home to have dinner, you know, 6:30, let's say. And then I would, we would usually go to a bunch of different bars, and I would say to my friends, you know, stay here, I'll be back in 20 minutes. And I would leave, and I would go home, and I would just randomly start an argument, and then I would storm out of the house and join my friends again. Right. Now, I didn't get into an argument. I created an argument, so I could go back and drink. That was the kind of thing, that was the kind of thing that I did. I was a wonderful husband. And so, you know, she got tired of me, and who can blame her? And then, you know, money started going missing, and you know what I mean? Like, you know how we are, you know what I mean? It's pathetic. Mm. And then, you know, the lies and the lies and the lies. And, you know, you just can't hide it anymore. You know what I mean? You can't hide it anymore. You can't bullshit your way out of everything. Maybe the first 2 times, you know? And then she said, you know, listen, I need you to leave, and what we're going to do is we're going to both get our lives together, and then we'll get back together again. That was what she said to me. So I was sort of to the point where, you know, I wanted out of there anyway. So I was like, well, good, you know, like now I can drink, you know what I mean? I don't have to be, she was doing something that drives everybody crazy, and that was, she was, you know, we'd go out and she'd start counting my drinks. Did anybody else ever experience that? Oh my God, it's the worst, I'm telling you, it's just the worst. Because, you know, you're not paying attention. Like, the last thing you need to know is how many drinks you had. You know what I mean? Like, you're just, you know, you've shot off the cliff. It doesn't matter to you. You know what I mean? Like, it's insignificant. It always sounds a lot worse than it is. You know, even though, you know, it's reality, but it's, you know, it's better that you not look at it. You know what I mean? Because you know it's bad. And so then I moved out. And, you know, I didn't try to get my life together. And then, you know, she wouldn't take me back. So, you know, on my resentment list was, you know, Wendy, you know, said that we would get back together again, and then we never did. And, you know, she's Satan, you know what I mean? Like, because I come from a family that's like the Brady Bunch. So, you know, everybody, well, my one brother was married twice, but, you know, everybody got married and is still married. Mm. Like, I don't relate to that. I've been married 3 times. I was then in an 11-year relationship, and now I'm currently not married. And then I looked at, okay, well, what's my mistakes? And then I was just like, wow, you know, I really tortured her, you know. It wasn't that she left, it's that I pushed her away. I wouldn't have stayed with me if I was with somebody that was doing the stuff I was doing. And I hadn't even done my 5th step yet, and I was like, wow, I feel so bad about Wendy. Man, I really screwed her. I wanted to make amends, and I hadn't even done my 5th step yet. I was totally seeing what was going on there. I totally saw how I created that whole situation. I actually put her through. It was a Thursday night. She went to school, and I decided to have a party over my house. And somebody brought the movie Caligula, the X-rated movie Caligula. And I wasn't watching it, but people were watching it in the living room. And then my wife, like, is coming toward the house, and there's all this noise. You know what I mean? Like, wonder where that party is, and it's at her house, you know what I mean? And she comes in, and there's, you know, these sex scenes, and, like, I'm in the back, like, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing? Like, well, it's my house, too, you know what I mean? What do you mean? Like, and she's like, you know, you hid this from me, and I said, I wasn't hiding it. It was at your house. Like I wasn't hiding it. If I was hiding it, I wouldn't have done it here. But I didn't understand what she was talking about. I didn't realize how incredibly inappropriate and incredibly inconsiderate that was, and how pathetic it was. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was really amazing because, you know, I'm just writing the fourth step and I'm just like, wow, this is, I'm totally seeing this differently. She went from Satan to, I am such an idiot. So many of my resentments, even before I did my fifth step, I got free of. And then while I was doing my fifth step, I got free of most of the rest of it. It was a really beautiful experience. And then, you know, another thing I wanted to point out about the resentment inventory is I have this extreme definition of what the word resentment is. And I know that this is an extreme definition, but I really like it because I'm an extreme kind of guy. And I think this definition helps a lot of people find a whole lot more resentment than they would normally find on their own. And the term that I use for resentment is any real or imagined reason for complaint. Is that extreme or what?
Wow.
That's a resentment. Any real or imagined reason for complaint.
Right.
So what I say to people that I work with and I say to people that call me, that, you know, if you complain about something more than once, it's a resentment. I know that that's an extreme definition. But it'll help people find more resentment. And how free do you want to be? Do you want to just find some of them or do you want to try to find all of them or most of them? So any real or imagined reason for complaint? If we complain about something more than once, it's a resentment. And then the fear inventory is always kind of cool. There's a humorous acronym for the word fear, and that's frantic efforts to appear recovered.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty good one. Forgot everything's all right. But there's one that's absolutely my favorite. It's probably the best acronym for fear as far as I'm concerned. And that is false evidence appearing real.
Mm-hmm.
There's a famous author, a really famous author, and he said this once, that the interesting thing about fear is that 95% of all my fears never happened. This is how cunning, baffling, and powerful our mind is. You know what I mean? It gets us afraid of stuff that never happens, and then we're just on to the next fear, and we didn't even notice that what it was telling us before this wasn't really happening in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
We're in this constant state of, this is our best thinking. The mind, and I'm going to talk about this when we do the meditation workshop, but the mind is like a three-trick pony. It has three strategies and three strategies only. The first strategy is be pissed about the past, otherwise known as resentment. The second strategy is be worried about the future, otherwise known as fear. And then the third strategy is whatever's happening right now is not significant. So don't focus on what's here now, which, by the way, is called reality. It's the only reality that we experience, is what is happening right here and right now. Right here and right now, ladies and gentlemen, we're sitting in a room and some guy's talking about some stuff. That's it. Your bill isn't due right this second. Your job isn't being threatened right this second. Your kid isn't whatever right this second. We're sitting in a room and we're listening to somebody and we have all this stuff in our head and it has nothing to do with reality at all. Because it's just rehashing the past and finding issues with it, and it's worried about the future, and the future hasn't happened and the future never happens. And when something we're concerned about becomes the present, then and only then are we empowered to do something about it. Our intuition kicks in when a person is running at us with a knife, our intuition kicks in on what we do about that. But our minds will be worried about some guy running at us with a knife. Before we even get to New York City, we have this whole scenario about how we're going to be raped and we're going to be mugged and we're going to be... And there's this whole story about no reality whatsoever because it's not happening right now. And there's no way we can deal with it because it's not happening and it probably doesn't happen. But it's a reality because that's what we're buying into in our head. There's this really famous line that I really love that always at some point during my workshop this comes out. And the quote is, you know, we all have a Grand Central Station mind, but we don't have to get on every train that comes through the station. One of the things that I do for people that call me is that, you know, after a few minutes, I'm like, dude, you got on a train. Get off the train. Mm-hmm. Get off the train. Hello, choo-choo. Your mind is rattling off. What's going to happen when you get home? You don't know what's going to happen when you get home. And you know what? What's even worse then? Your mind's rattling off a bunch of stuff that's going to happen when you get home and you haven't gotten home yet. When you anticipate, when you create in your head that when I get home it's going to be bad, mm-hmm. that's called a self-fulfilling prophecy. I learned this the hard way. My third wife at the time, I had an issue with one of her kids who was a little bit difficult. And I started catching myself, you know, this is all, you know, within months. And then I sort of straightened my mind out and it kind of changed everything. The first months that we were together, I had in my head dreading going home because I wasn't sure what we would find when we got home. Because there were always problems. And so I had in my mind, look for the bad things that are happening. It's sort of like, you know, if I say to you, you know, look around this room and look for all the things in this room that are red. So you look around the room and, you know, you see a few things that are red. And then I ask you to close your eyes and I say, okay, how many things in this room are blue? Well, I didn't see any blue things. I was looking for red. So when I was looking for whatever the kids were doing wrong, when I got home, I was always able to find something. And then finally I said, you know, I'm going to try to use this in reverse. I'm going to, before I go home, I'm going to reverse it. I'm going to say, you know what, before I get home, I need to pray and I need to ask God to help me. Help me to see the good that the kids are, or the good things when I walk into the house. And then I started seeing good things were happening. They were always happening. I was just focused on the bad. It doesn't mean the bad wasn't there. I just wasn't focused on it anymore. It wasn't driving me nuts anymore after that. It changed everything. And then because I wasn't looking for the bad, my relationship with her completely changed. Because I wasn't looking for the bad in her. I wasn't expecting her to be bad. And since I was expecting her to be bad, she stood up and showed me that she was bad. Because I was creating that. I energetically created that. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as I started you know, trying to look for the good, and even, you know, commenting to her about, oh, you know, You did that thing at school. That was really nice. You know what I mean? Like, all of a sudden, it completely changed the environment, and it completely changed my relationship with her. Totally wild. I don't know why I talked about that in the fear inventory, but let's move along. You see, something that, for me, is really, really important is that the mind creates many, 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 many more problems than it ever solves. The mind is always saying, here's a. I just created a problem, and now what I want you to do is I want you to seek me out to solve that problem. And if we really look at it, wait a minute, you just created the problem. I'm not going to turn to you for the help with the problem. I need to turn to something else for the solution. I'm not going to turn to the person who caused the problem to get the solution to the problem. That's what the mind does. Is that the mind creates a situation and then wants you to turn to it for help to deal with that situation. Another thing that's really surprising about the mind is that the mind gets you to do something that you know that you shouldn't be doing, and then it beats you up for doing it. This is the thing that you're turning to, you know, your whole life for help. Like, it's insane.
Right.
Why is it that nobody notices this? And then the fear inventory is basically, the first column is, I list my fears, and then the second column is, why do I have those fears? And then the third column is, how am I creating those fears? Hmm. The third column is sort of like the fourth column of the resentment inventory. And then the fourth column of the fear inventory is the opposite. What should I have done instead? No, I think that might be the harms one. But the columns are, I list my fears. Why do I have the fears? How am I creating the fear? How am I creating the fear, or how am I perpetuating the fear? And then the fourth column is basically the opposite of the, I ask God to remove the fear and show me what he would have me be. Mm-hmm. And what he would have me be would be the opposite of what's creating the fear, obviously. And then I don't have so many fears. I don't have so many fears. And the fears I have are just normal fears. Like, you know, if a lion starts walking toward me, that's a normal fear. Like, you know what I mean? If you don't freak out, you know what I mean? Like, you don't want, oh, I think I'll go pet that thing. You know what I mean? Like, right. This puppy I wanted to go pet. A lion is a different story, you know?
Right.
And then the sex and harms inventory. It's interesting, our sex life, or lack of. And it's interesting the way that we harm people in such self-centered ways. And then the four-column inventory for the fear and harm, or the sex and harms inventory is, you know, who did I harm? Did I arouse jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness? You know, what did I do wrong? And what should I have done instead? So it's similar to the fear inventory, where the third column is, you know, what did I do? Where was I selfish and dishonest and afraid? And the fourth column is the opposite of what the third column is. Mm-hmm. And then the last part of the fourth step, as far as I'm concerned, is the relationship ideal. And I don't know about you, but, you know, I never had an ideal for who I wanted to be in relationship with. Like I said earlier, you know, the women, until I got into recovery, the women that I seemed to be attracted to and that seemed to be the women that I would get into short-term relationships with would be, the relationship would start like this. Well, I guess you like me, so I guess I like you. That was pretty much what started the relationship. I didn't know what I wanted in a relationship, but a woman sort of showed some interest, so I guess, you know, you like me, so I guess I like you. In other words, my idea at the time of Mrs. Right was Mrs. Right Now. It's pretty much what it was. And then later, it was, you know, I married Mrs. Right, but I didn't realize her first name was Always. You have to kind of think about that one. Mm-hmm. But I didn't have an ideal for what I wanted to get into a relationship. And it's interesting because what I found myself, where I found myself trapped was every relationship would be like, you know, it was the same relationship, different face. Mm-hmm. I was in a series of relationships with women that I was attracted to, but I would never marry. And the type of woman that I was attracted to before I got sober was women that were incredibly beautiful but were sort of emotionally volatile, which is sort of an interesting combination, I have to tell you. And it's funny because I can even sense now, because I'm single now, and I can even sense now when it's one of those again. Like, I just have an internal response to it, that no. I have this internal no now that was a real big yes at the time. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, I just know, you know, I can think it through today, but I couldn't think it through in the beginning. And, you know, I remember even saying to her, I saw a psychiatrist for a very brief period of time. That was the only time I went to psychiatry. And I said to him that, you know, what are you supposed to do? The type of woman attracted to isn't a woman that I would marry. It's not a woman I would bring home to my mom. And he said to me, you know, did you ever, you know, write down what you want in a relationship? And I was just like, people do that? Like, I would have never thought of that. I would have never thought of that. And then I started seeing in the big book, it mentions this relationship ideal. And it's funny because ever since the moment I wrote down my ideal, I've been in nothing but long-term relationships. Because I don't compromise on the ideal. And, you know, there's been some things that were on the list that are no longer on the list. Like, you know, when I first put it together, like 20-something years ago, I wanted to get into a relationship with somebody that I wanted to have a family. Mm-hmm. And now I'm 56, so I kind of accept that I wasn't meant to have any kids. And one of my wives her son is sort of my son, so I sort of have a kid, but he's not my biological kid, but I'm closer to him than anybody is. I'm closer to him than both of his parents, actually. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not on my list anymore. And I'm not necessarily saying I'm disregarding it. I just figure, you know, life didn't want me to have any kids. I'm 56. I don't have the energy for it anymore. Let me leave it at that. And there's two kind of things that you put on the list. One is non-negotiable, and the other one is sort of a preference, but it's not a deal breaker. In other words, I like redheads. But if they're not a redhead, it's not a deal breaker. Mm-hmm. Monogamous, definitely not that's a deal breaker. Fun. I need to be in a relationship with somebody who's fun. Honest. I think at this point in my life, I'd like to be in a relationship. I probably should add this to the list, to somebody who provides me with food. Right? I think I'll throw that one in. Because I know I'm not doing a good job. That's for damn sure.
Right.
I have somebody here. Oh, okay. Well, somebody put it in the middle, cannot be enough.
So this is the fourth step. We got three inventories, and then we create an ideal. And before we finish the fourth step, we know who we're going to do our fifth step with. Let me say it again. Before we finish the fourth step, we know who we're going to do our fifth step with. Because it says in the fifth step that, you know, we have a fourth step and we waste no time to do our fifth step. So it's important to not delay. Because taking too long with the fourth step or waiting too long to do a fifth step is psychologically abusive. It's really, really bad. I mean, ask anybody who's ever basically, you know, started their fourth step and then just put it down. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. You want to talk about a nightmare kind of situation. Because what starts to happen is that you've brought to your consciousness and your subconscious and your unconscious, you've drawn out certain things and now it's in your conscience. Mm-hmm. And now you not only begin to start to relive that, but you even start to redo it if you don't go on to the rest of the process. You see, 5 through 9 is sort of the healing salve. 4 is the opening of the wound, and 5 through 9 is the healing salve. That it's sort of like 4 is like, you know, when you were small, you broke your arm, but you didn't realize it. So then, and then you grew up with a arm that didn't heal properly. And then when you do your fourth and fifth step, the way you deal with a broken bone that didn't heal right is that you have to break it again and then put it in the right position, and then and only then is it going to heal properly. And that's what the fourth and fifth step is like. You have to re-break your arm. You have to re-break your psychiatry in order to allow it to grow properly or to be proper or whatever. So I never got to the fifth step, so we'll do that next week.
Okay.
We have stuff for people to work with again. So this is the spiritual exercise to work with for the next week. Also, if you were not here last week, there's 2 CDs you can have for free as a Christmas present. And thanks for letting me share.
Thank you.